stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Doctors Without Borders says the death toll from the U.S. airstrike on its hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, has risen to 22. The medical group says 12 hospital and 10 patients were killed in the attack, including three children. The group says it has now withdrawn from Kunduz. The Afghan Interior Ministry said 10 to 15 insurgents were hiding in the hospital's grounds at the time of the attack. The U.S. military acknowledged conducting a pre-dawn airstrike in the vicinity of the hospital. Russia said today its forces continued intensifying airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Syria and that the bombings have disrupted the group's infrastructure and logistical support. But opposition fighters in the region and their spokesperson say they are the groups being targeted, as Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Syrian government media reported heavy airstrikes on opposition-held towns of Homs and Idlib. The Russian Defense Ministry showed videos of bombs striking what they claimed were arms depots and terrorist command centers. Video from Syrian opposition groups showed victims of what they claimed were Russian airstrikes on the towns of Telbisi and Rastan. Syrian opposition leader Khaled al-Hoja claimed most of the Russian attacks were aimed at what he called moderate opposition targets. Appearing on Syrian TV, President Bashar al-Assad defended the Russian military operation he authorized last week. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Nigerian police and witnesses are linking Friday's two explosions outside Abuja, the capital, to male and female suicide bombers. No group has claimed responsibility, but authorities have linked the attacks to Boko Haram, which has been in the area. This is VOA News. Israeli police say they are restricting access to Jerusalem's whole old city after a Palestinian man fatally stabbed two Israelis. The Palestinian militant group Islamic Jihad said the attacker was a member. Baruch Marzel is an Israeli right-wing activist.
Netanyahu has to resign. Netanyahu failed. He gave the Arabs to incite for months in Jerusalem. He gave the Arabs to attack Jews in Jerusalem. Today there was four Jews dead. Netanyahu has their blood on his hands.
Recent fighting at the Al-Aqsa compound in East Jerusalem has seen is Palestinian protesters throwing stones and firebombs at non-Muslims who are allowed under Israeli law to visit the site. Israel captured the territory along with the West Bank from Jordan in the 1967 war, but Palestinians claim the territory is the capital of their future state. The flood of refugees and other migrants into Europe this year is boosting support among anti-immigrant political parties in many of the affected countries. In Austria, the far-right Freedom Party could, for the first time, win city elections in Vienna from the Social Democrats, who have dominated politics there for decades. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Vienna.
Ahead of citywide elections, far-right politicians are capitalizing on fears of an influx of foreigners, most of them Muslims.
It's about, as you said before, migrants and the fears of people, I guess, which I think is absolutely ridiculous because we live in one of the richest countries in the world, so I don't see the point.
Vienna, like most European capitals, boasts a wealth of culture, architecture, and history, as well as cultural diversity and left-wing politics. But like much of Europe, politics are turning to the right, and that has many here worried. The Freedom Party says it wants to protect Austrian culture and Europe from Islamization, and its message is finding an audience. Polls show it is neck and neck with the Social Democrats, who have led Vienna politics since the end of World War II. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Vienna.
Authorities in the U.S. state of Oregon say the gunman who killed eight students and a teacher at a community college earlier this week committed suicide after a brief shootout with police. The heavily armed 26-year-old shooter left a hate-filled note at the scene, which, according to news reports, said he felt the world was against him. An Oregon resident speaks out on the issue of gun control.
Well, you're going to hear people jump on the bandwagon for gun control, and yes, we need to look at that, but let's not kid ourselves and think that that's the cure-all. There's more issues that we need to look at the whole picture and be able to not only look at gun control, but help for those that are suffering mentally.
President Obama spoke to the American people after the shooting, saying he wants everyone to press Congress to take some action on gun control reform. I'm Artie Johnson, reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
They are selecting the unity state by attacking their state position. So monitoring is not effective because the rebels have rejected and refused to be part of the ceasefire monitoring.
South Sudanese government denies attacking rebel positions in the oil-producing unity state.
We considered all possibilities of protracting this struggle through the strike, and we realized that legally the teachers were going to be worn out.
Kenyan teachers returned to the classrooms on Monday after weeks of strike action to demand pay increase.
In the position where I was standing, I could see policemen who were shooting, standing in canals on the road.
And anti-government protesters and police clash in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The spokesman for the South Sudanese National Army says rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar have been deceiving the international community. This after the rebels accused the government troops of attacking their positions in unity state for the past 3 days. They say the government wants to gain control of the areas the rebels have been holding for a number of months. But Army spokesman Colonel Philip Aguer denied the accusation, saying that the rebels are to blame for violating the recently signed ceasefire agreement.
The rebels are misleading the world because it is them that are violating the ceasefire, and they have already rejected the ceasefire by not signing it and by not accepting the monitoring and verification. We invited the United Nations and the United States to help in providing monitoring and verification mechanism in South Sudan, which the rebels have refused. So they are neither part of the monitoring or part of the ceasefire. They are still is the one respecting the ceasefire. Otherwise, we would have overrun all the locations that the rebels are occupying today. But we are only fighting in self-defense.
So, Colonel Aguer, you are definitely saying that the National Army is not attacking rebel positions in Unity State near the northern border with Sudan?
Yes, exactly. We have never attacked the rebels. The rebels attacking us in Lair for the last 5 days in Kuch County on the 2nd of this month. SPLA have never gone out to attack the rebels.
There have been accusations and counter-accusations here and there, and therefore they say that the recent attacks for the last 3 days, they assume is for the government to take charge of their positions to make you stronger in the implementation of the peace process. And this, they said, violates the peace accord itself. You are not enthused about this accusation, are you?
Riek Machar is occupying only one county in Unity State. More than 95% of Unity State is under control of the government. If the rebels are serious and they really wanted peace, let them join the monitoring. And we, together with the rebels, officers and United Nations mission in Sudan, will go and monitor the ceasefire if they are serious. Let them join the IGAD monitoring team, and we'll go together to the front, and we verify who is violating the ceasefire.
Now, from your side so far, Colonel Aguer, how is the monitoring of the implementation of the ceasefire agreement going so far?
The monitoring is not effective because you cannot monitor with one party refusing the monitoring. The rebels of Riek Machar have refused and rejected the monitoring mechanism. This is why they are not on the ground. We were expecting them after the security was in Addis Ababa. We had been expecting the rebels to send their officers to come to Juba. They refused, and this is why we are sure that the rebels have a different motive. This is how they are reflecting the unity state by attacking their SPLA position. So monitoring is not effective because the rebels have rejected and refused to be part of the ceasefire monitoring.
What about your call to the U.S. and the international community, particularly including IGAD, in the implementation process? So what has been their response so far?
we had been informing the IGAD that they should convince the rebel to join the monitoring. What is left now is a gap that is created by the IGAD by not placing on the ground monitoring mechanism that involve both the government and the rebels. If the IGAD did do that, definitely we will not be talking about rebels spreading lies about the government attacking them. The government, until today, they are mobilizing in the borders of the northern Sudan or Sudan, and we know where they are mobilizing, and they are preparing for more attacks.
How prepared are you in order to protect people there if they are preparing to attack your positions as well as civilians?
Our forces are ready in Manakal, Iran, in Maban, and they are monitoring where the rebels are distributing ammunition and arms that are being brought from Khartoum. SPLA is only maintaining a defensive position in this town.
Colonel Philip Agwe is the spokesman for the South Sudanese National Army. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. The Secretary General of Kenya's Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers, or CUPET, says teachers will return to the classroom on Monday after suspending their strike action. Akello Mizori says the government has not been fair to the teachers, despite a court ruling which ordered that salaries of teachers should be increased between 50% to 60%. Mizori told me earlier today that the teachers would embark on another round of industrial action if the government fails to increase their pay.
That's correct. We considered all possibilities of protracting this struggle through the strike, and we realized that legally the teachers were going to be worn out, and the teachers were going to be exposed to mischievous schemes by government to employ teachers on who are supposed to fill the gaps of the teachers who are on strike. And the procedure was going to be faulty, and was going to subject as to unnecessary litigation in future.
But the Teachers Service Commission appealed the pay increase despite the court order for them to pay. This court case will be heard tomorrow, Monday. What is your response to that?
Now, the appeal has been on from July, and when we started prosecuting it, the Attorney General came out very forcefully to defend the position of government not to pay and that of Teacher Service Commission. But now there are two things: that did the trial court in June break the law? Did the trial court misuse the facts which were before him? Now, in our understanding, we say, yes, let them prosecute the case, but we know very well that the issue may not end up being resolved through the court process, because the government may not have their own way in court. They have got a very weak case, and the law was not broken. The facts were those which were provided for the trial judge to make a determination. So their appeal is on, and you know, we had two cases also, because when we went on strike, they went to stop the strike, but the trial judge again at the employment court declined to grant them the orders of making the strike illegal and unprotected. So the strike still remained protected and legal. But this one does not serve well the country. And we cannot expose the teachers to mischief even when the government decides to disobey the law.
The appeals court will listen to the 50 to 60% pay raise awarded to you. In this case, if it's not favorable to teachers, you will not get your increase. Where does this leave you?
No, in the trial court, we still have provision of 90 days to execute an industrial action. And we know very well that as much as the government wants to protect its image, not to award the teachers the 50 and 60%, and even as much as they threaten the courts not to look at this, we are saying that our mandate does not end with a court determination. Our mandate as unions are enshrined in the Constitution as Article 41. So we shall still use the tools of last resort in our favor in future to ensure that after these 90 days, we can as well institute a process of industrial action. So the teacher struggle will continue irrespective of the outcome of what will take place when the appeal court finally determines this issue.
What happens to the teachers? Because the government, as you said, made a move to hire teachers to fill in the gaps of the striking teachers. If the government resort to that again, what
that
can you
one
do?
Is already said by the court. The court on 30th did stay that process. They were injuncted not to recruit, and we are all systems go in terms of how we are handling the government with its recklessness and intransigence in manner handling the teacher issues. So we think there is no option for government but to listen to this case, execute it to the last digit in court. But when they fail to do so, we still have open-ended check of how to handle them using the provisions of the law.
Akello Mizori is the Secretary General of Kenya's Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers, or CUPET. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. Anti-government protesters and police clashed Saturday in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig reports Burundi has dealt with unrest on and off since April.
Heavy shelling, gunfire, and explosions hit several Bujumbura neighborhoods Saturday. Human Rights Watch senior researcher on Burundi and Rwanda, Karina Tertsakian, says there are a few details available.
It's usually the same troubled areas of Bujumbura where there are these clashes. So there were violent clashes. We believe there were some deaths, some injuries, but we haven't been able to confirm how many, and we haven't yet been able to confirm exactly what happened.
Medical student Ngabo Spagian says he was in Ngagara neighborhood.
In the position where I was standing, I could see policemen who were shooting, standing in canals on the road. Then I saw how they were shooting during this afternoon. There were also some guys who were hiding in the houses along the roads who were throwing grenades on policemen.
Burundi has been in turmoil since April, when President Pierre Nkurunziza made his bid for a third term in office, a move opponents say violates the constitution and a peace deal that ended the war in 2006. In May, Burundi Army General Godefroy Niyombare announced a coup over the radio while the president was out of the country, raising fears that more violence would be taking place. The coup was unsuccessful. Nkurunziza was re-elected in July, but not without suspicion. The United Nations, African Union, and other governments concluded the elections were not free and fair. Tertsakian says the pattern of protest has continued.
It can be every day that there are clashes like that, and there's a lull, and then it starts again, and then it calms down again. So that's how it's been for quite a few months now.
Journalists are also being targeted. Private radio stations were taken off the air, and reporters have been threatened and attacked.
That, you know, there are a lot of rumors flying around when things like this happen, as I'm sure you know, and it's partly because of the absence of independent media in Burundi that all kinds of rumors fly around.
But Spagian says Bujumbura residents have learned to live between the clashes.
I'm not afraid because it is now like the current life of Bujumbura people. There are sometimes it explodes, other times it's calm. And things like that, yeah.
And residents are hoping the calm will outlast the storm. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Zimbabwean parliamentarians have rejected proposals aimed to take over the Premier Service Medical Aid Society's $144 million debt. For VOA reporter Patricia Mudadigwa has details from the capital, Harare.
On July 16th, President Robert Mugabe gazetted Statutory Instrument 77 of 2015, which prohibits issuance of attachment orders on state property. The president invoked his presidential powers to protect PISMA's properties from being attached by service providers owed $144 million. Discussing the statutory instrument yesterday, members of parliament were in agreement that allowing government to take over the PISMA's debt was promoting corruption. Buera South Member of Parliament Joseph Chinotimba said it was wrong for the country to take over the debt.
Mr. Speaker, can I find the Mr. Speaker, say, I and my Buhera South constituency do not agree that the country should inherit the Pismas debt. Pismas should sell its properties to offset the debt.
Fortune Chasi, another ZANPF legislator representing Mazowe South, expressed the same sentiments.
By the looks of things, we seem to be a government that wants to reward corruption. This is not going to come time that comes home. If the push comes to a shove.
MDCT lawmaker Jesse Majome of Harare West was also not happy at all about moves to take over the debt. The House, which in many cases debates issues along parties and lines, showed rare unity, with Priscilla Misaira Mbwimushonga of the MDC, led by Professor Washman Ngube, noting that members of parliament were debating the issue in an objective manner.
For some of us, it is a historic day because both sides of the House are in total agreement. And I'm hoping that we can continuously look at things in this manner.
Harare resident Amos Diroto praised the legislators for speaking against parceling the debt to the government.
I think what the legislators did yesterday is quite commendable, given that the president was just used at bulldozing such laws in favor of those who have plundered our resources.
Another resident, Samson Zingai, urged government to ensure that those that contributed to the collapse of Pismas be held accountable.
I think it is an abuse of power on the part of the president to evoke his presidential powers, especially on this Pismas bill, because we know those powers, they exist in the constitution, but then for him to invoke it so that the people will assume the debt that was accrued through misuse and misgovernance and corruption is quite bad, and there were no investigations that were taken.
The government also took over the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe debt a couple of months ago after the RBZ Debt Assumption Act sailed through parliament, despite fierce resistance from members of the opposition. The RBZ owed service providers US$1.35 billion, which was taken over by the government. In Harare, this is Patricia Mdadigwa.
Genetically modified crops first appeared in global markets in the mid-90s, but most African nations have remained lukewarm about embracing them. Today, rising hunger rates, unpredictable weather patterns, and recurrent disease and pest attacks are contributing to concerns about food security. They are also leading government in Africa to think again about adopting the scientifically enhanced foods. From Douala, Intarike Divine reports from Cameroon.
Mere mention of genetically modified organisms or GMOs has triggered vibrant debate across Africa.
We are talking about those organisms modified artificially using technology in the laboratory.
Professor Vincent Titanji is Vice Chancellor at the Cameroon Christian University in Yaoundé.
You bring genes from one species to another and then either improve or change it in some manner that it becomes more efficient in its environment.
But despite such advances, concerns about GMOs have generally dwarfed the benefits across Africa. From policymakers to farmers and consumers, most agriculture stakeholders reject GMOs as an answer to rising malnutrition and outdated farming methods. In Cameroon's rural areas, for example, highly religious peasant farmers consider genetic modification outright blasphemy. Beatrice Ngenge, a maize grower in the country's hilly northwest, compares GMOs to attempts at human cloning by scientists in the West. She says they are both responsible for human suffering.
Whenever we go against God, we must prepare to bear the consequences. How can simple human beings think they are God?
Many, like her, stick tightly to antiquated farming methods, only reluctantly embracing pesticides and fertilizers to improve yields. Such hardline attitudes are reinforced by civil society activists. Bernard Njonga is leader of the Cameroon Collective Against GMOs. He says, like narcotics, genetically altered planting material will eventually hook farmers, rendering them dependent on seeds and chemicals they cannot afford.
Imaginez le petit paysan. S'il utilise l'OGM, il est obligé de racheter.
Imagine the peasant farmer using GMOs that he obliged to purchase. He will need authorization because GMOs are patented. They threaten the health of the population because some are said to cause cancer. France, Germany, England have prohibited GMOs from their farms and plates. Why should we foolishly embrace them? From now on, we would fight to prevent this evil from entering Cameroon.
Et on se battra pour que ce mal n'entre pas au Cameroun.
Njonga voiced the opposition in early September at a first ever government organized forum on the stakes and challenges of adopting GMOs to boost Cameroon's agricultural production. Besides oil, agriculture has been the backbone of the Central African nation's economy, employing over 70% of its workforce and contributing enormously to its GDP. But in recent years, and with food prices exploding amid harvest slumps, the government is considering dropping its precautionary stance on genetically modified organisms. Emmanuel Bonde is Minister of Mines, Industries and Technological Development. He says the plan to embrace GMOs will be gradual.
Cette question fait l'objet de débats contradictoires.
This issue evokes debates. Therefore, we would first reinforce the capacity of our conventional agriculture through increased mechanization and local transformation before contemplating the controlled integration of GMOs in our development process.
Dans notre processus de développement.
He says the scare campaign by anti-GMO activists is scientifically groundless. So far, there have been no reported allergies, human health complications, or long-term negative side effects from consuming genetically modified organisms. And besides, advocates add that Africa is teetering on the brink of starvation, with some 2.9 million hunger-related deaths per year. They say failure to consider scientifically improved yields means continued dependence on Western food aid.
Les OGM sont certainement un facteur de développement.
GMOs are certainly a factor of development because if we consider our food security and population growth in Cameroon within the context of stagnating agricultural production.
Waman Mbele is a senior official in the Ministry of the Environment. He says Cameroon and Africa in general will eventually have no choice but resort to GMOs.
It is only normal to revert to advanced technologies. Today, cotton production is stagnating and growers are envisaging genetically modified cotton as a solution.
He argues GMO crops that can be grown in less time and with reduced production costs will lift millions out of poverty and curb rising hunger. However, he warns that African governments planning to embrace the biotechnology should introduce precise legislation and support public enlightenment campaigns to help reduce consumer opposition to GMO foods. From Douala in Cameroon, I'm Tariq Edovan Jr. for VOA News.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Riek Machar, South Sudan's opposition leader and former vice president, will sit down with host Shaka Sali. We'll discuss the recent peace accord and examine the country's uncertain future as the November deadline for the agreement draws near. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on Straight Talk Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, October 4th. Let's kick off with African football news. Algerian club USM Algiers reached the final of the 2015 CAF Champions League, the more prestigious of Africa's two club football competitions. USM reached the first ever final of a major continental club championship on Saturday, after playing goalless with visiting Al Hilal of Sudan in their return leg semi-final. USM, called Reds and Blacks, won last week's first leg in Omdurman, Sudan, 2-1. Prior to the 2015 championship, the best performance of the Algerian club was reaching the semi-final of the 2003 edition of the Champions League, where it was eliminated by eventual winner Enyimba of Nigeria. For its part, Al Hilal, finalists in 1987 and 5 years later, will have to wait till next year to begin yet another journey towards breaking its African club title jinx. USMA will face either TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo or Al Merrikh of Sudan in the grand finale at the end of October. In Africa's other club football competition, the CAF Confederation Cup, Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia has reached the final. The Tunisians got to the last stage 5-4 on aggregate, despite losing 3-0 to Egyptian club Zamalek in the return leg semi-final in Cairo on Saturday. Etoile had won the first leg in Tunisia last week, 5-1. This is the third time that Etoile will reach the CAF Confederation Cup final. On Saturday, the Tunisian club played the last 15 minutes of the match with only 10 men after one of its players bagged the red card. Etoile du Sahel, winner of the competition in 2006 and runner-up 2 years later, will play defending champion Al Ahly of Egypt or Orlando Pirates of South Africa in the two-leg final. Staying with football news, the African qualifiers for the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia kicks off this Wednesday. Some 26 countries will play over two legs in the first round. The 13 aggregate winners will advance to the second round, where they will join 27 other teams for another round of home and away matches. The 20 aggregate winners will advance to the third and final round. In that round, the 20 teams will be divided into 5 groups of 4 teams each. After playing home and away round-robin matches, the winners of each group will qualify to represent Africa at the 2018 FIFA World Cup. In a related development, World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has moved the World Cup first round match from the Central African Republic to Madagascar for safety reasons. The match was moved due to clashes in the capital of the Central African Republic, Bangui, that left about 40 people dead last week. The Central African Republic was due to host Madagascar in Bangui next Saturday, with the return leg in the Malagasy capital, Antananarivo, on October 13th. FIFA said both matches will now be played in Madagascar. Two other African countries will not be able to play their World Cup qualifiers at home next week. Somalia, which has not played at home since October 1986 due to the conflict in that country, hosts Niger in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa on Friday, with the return leg of the first round in Niger's capital, Niamey, 4 days later. And Sierra Leone, still barred from hosting matches because of the Ebola virus, will play away in the first leg of its match against Chad on Saturday, and then host the return leg on October 13th in Port Harcourt, here in Nigeria. It will be the second time that Sierra Leone has used Port Harcourt as venue for one of its qualifiers. Last month, Sierra Leone held African champion Ivory Coast to a goalless draw in Port Harcourt in the 2017 African Nations Cup qualifier. Turning to women's football, Cameroon came from behind to beat Zimbabwe 2-1 on Saturday in the final round of first leg qualifier for the 2016 Olympic Games women's football. The Cameroonians would have to avoid defeat in the return leg in a fortnight in Harare to realize their Olympic dream. For its part, South Africa was held goalless by visiting Equatorial Guinea in Johannesburg. The decider will be played in Malabo, capital of Equatorial Guinea, in 2 weeks. The two aggregate winners will represent Africa at the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
You were carrying my load. You said you would be my God. Oh. Now I'm in your presence to have my own portion. You were carrying my load. You said you would be my God, Daddy. Now I'm in your presence.
For that Lord, my God, will arise. And you will see me lifted so high. For the downfall of any man is not the end of his life. You will carry my load.
You will carry my load.
Remember
that you will be my God. Lord. Now I'm in your presence. You have my own portion.
You will carry my load.
You will carry my load. You said you will be my God. Lord. Now I'm in your presence. You have my own portion.
You will carry my load.
You will carry my load. You said you will be my God. Lord. Now I'm in your presence. You have my own portion.
You will carry my load.
You will carry my load.
You said you will be my God.
Now I'm in your presence. Now I'm in your presence. You have my own.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. A large number of African heads of state and government are attending the 70th General Assembly, which marks the 70th birthday of the founding of the United Nations in 1945. The heads of state also attended the summit of the Sustainable Development Goals, which is a follow-up to the Millennium Development Goals, which ends this year, starting in 2000. In contrast to the MDGs, these new Sustainable Development Goals includes every member state. In addition, the determination of the contribution of developed countries was mentioned. It was absent in the MGD, and they are asked to contribute 0.7% to development assistance. The cost for this new program, the Sustainable Development Program, should be about $3 trillion and should end in 2030. The Eastern states and government, Africa and others, also spent a great deal of time in talking about the reform of the United Nations. The African states in particular spoke very, very fervently about the need to revive the power and influence of the General Assembly. In the last 18 years, the power and influence of the Assembly has diminished, and most of its activities have been transferred to the 15 members Security Council, where Africa has 3 representatives. But the fact of the matter is that of the 15 members, the 5 permanent members do have a firm grip on the Council, and they determine what is happening in that council. The African states have argued that in a reformed Security Council, Africa should have 2 new permanent seats and 2 new additional non-permanent seats. This is the position of the Africans. But the permanent members, some of them at least, not including China, because China supports the African position, since 1996, not much progress has been made in reforming the Security Council. And frankly, the prospects are not bright, mainly because some of the permanent members are not willing to relinquish some of their power and influence in the Security Council. President Zuma, in his statement, spoke about an aspect of the United Nations reform which is not often discussed in the General Assembly. Taking into account that the term of office of the current Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, ends next year, President Zuma suggested that the process of electing the new Secretary General should be on the agenda. He correctly noted that in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations, only the General Assembly should elect the Secretary General on the recommendation of the Security Council. But over the years, the practice has developed that what matters is only the recommendation of the Council. Now, this commentator in the UN some years back did propose that in the selection of the Secretary General, the Security Council should send to the General Assembly 3 candidates, not just 1, 3 candidates, and leave it up to the General Assembly to make a selection, an election of the Secretary General. Quite frankly, they would not do it. And the reason being that some of the permanent members only want to elect a weak candidate as Secretary General. They made a mistake twice with Dag Hammarskjöld and Boutros Ghali, and they do not want to repeat the mistake. And therefore, they will not accept the proposal to give more than 1 candidate to the General Assembly. But they should remember, and the members should remember, that the Secretariat is one of the principal organs of the United Nations, and the head is Secretary General, could determine what or not the UN could do. And therefore, we need a new strengthened Secretary General, one that will set forth a program like was done by both Dag Hammarskjöld and Boutros Ghali. But one permanent member of the Security Council once made a remark when Boutros Ghali was vetoed. She said that what the UN need is not a Secretary General. They need a secretary and not a general. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impoga, Producer Odette Frazier, Sports Editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And as the elders say, you do not teach the paths of the forest to an old gorilla. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is donating $15.7 million worth of food commodities to Malawi to assist a portion of the 2.8 million people in need of humanitarian food assistance. U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, made the announcement in late September. This assistance is in response to the government of Malawi's September 21st appeal for donor support following the Vulnerability Assessment Committee findings in July 2015. As a result of the unfavorable 2014-2015 farming season, 2.8 million Malawians in 24 districts will require food assistance from October 2015 to March 2016. The late onset of rains, severe flooding, mid-season dry spells, and early ending of rains contributed to the approximately 30% reduction in Malawi's maize crop. The UN Food Program will receive and distribute the United States food donation of 6,250 metric tons of beans and 2,810 metric tons of vitamin A and D fortified vegetable oil as part of a larger food basket designed to meet the nutritional requirements of those in need. The food donation will arrive in Malawi beginning in October 2015. Since 2012, the United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has provided over $55 million worth of food assistance to address food insecurity stemming from recurrent adverse weather in Malawi. In August 2014, the United States provided $7 million through the World Food Program to support the MVAC response to the seasonal food insecurity that affected 640,000 people in 19 districts across Malawi. Earlier this year, the United States provided further assistance, totaling $9.3 million, to Malawi when the country experienced widespread, devastating floods. Beyond our humanitarian assistance, the United States provides approximately $25 million per year under President Obama's Feed the Future and climate change initiatives that are building resilience among vulnerable households in central and southern Malawi. U.S. Ambassador to Malawi, Virginia Palmer, stressed that it is important to tackle agricultural shortfalls holistically. The United States, she said, is committed to Malawi's welfare and development, and we are proud to partner with the people of Malawi in this time of need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.